First of all, last week to do just a minimal amount of rehearsal, I talked about the neshama, and we talked about basically the beauty of the neshama and the fact that the neshama, its beauty that is because it is a fragment of the divine. Now, one thing, let me look here. Okay, I'm sorry. It's a fragment of God, and so some people have said, you know, it's like an atom. So if you look at the, you know, the molecules and the things of the, you know, the cosmos, it's like having one atom that belongs to God. And, you know, that thought in and of itself is phenomenal, because, you know, here you are, you have this this piece of God. I am missing someone on this list.
Is Marilyn online?
She is, it looks like she's talking to somebody. I don't know who.
Hmm. Well, her and Avi Nair, too, said he'd be in class tonight there.
Okay, we're getting everybody else lined up. Okay, very good. Okay, so last week what we did is we talked about the neshama, and I have several other things to say about that this evening, but one of the things that we said in a little bit of a rehearsal is that the neshama, and everybody please turn off your microphones, and the neshama is a fragment of God. This is what the Jewish scholars, the Jewish rabbis, and those who deal with the deeper side of Jewish life, what they say about the neshama. And they say that it's a fragment of the divine, or like a fragment of the divine essence. Now, when you think about that, it is a bit like the idea of having an atom of, say, the nuclear material that, you know, powers these power plants and stuff like that, these gigantic steam turbines and everything. And so it'd be like having a molecule or an atom of uranium, and that would be, you know, your life source, the power that would power you throughout the rest of your life, or however long that it should last, etc. So in a sense, you know, the same is true in having a fragment of the divine, having a fragment of God. And then if you stop to use that analogy a little bit, you would say that the fragment of the divine, because it's God, it would have to last forever. And so this actually has made me come to some conclusions that normally I might not have made in with regards to some circumstances. Okay, so just to put it briefly and non-explicitly, when we think about who will be a part of the Olam Haba, we generally tend to speak or think in terms of, you know, those who are righteous, those who are collectively joined in some way to the body of God. And, you know, for us, you know, we have a connection through Messiah, but nevertheless, it's still fundamentally the same. But there, that leaves a lot of people on the outside of what we would possibly consider the outside that don't connect with God in the way, say, that you or I might, and God is not necessarily their priority. Now, that being said, you would say, well, who gets to go to the Olam Haba and who doesn't? And one of the things I can say quickly about that information is, I don't know. And I'm not qualified to make that choice. So that's something that you, if you're going to ask that question, that's something you have to ask God. But I've come up with this in the process, and I don't know that this is even remotely an idea of how this works, but I'm going to give you this in the short and see if I can explain it to some capacity. Okay, there is a thought that we live in the earth, and then, of course, we have an association with things of the earth. Now, one of the things I've said over the years when I talk with people is that, you know, the accumulation of things, and this is not a negativity toward possessions, okay? So don't take it to that extreme, all right? But the idea of, you know, having physical items is, you know, some of that is, you know, a show of the fact that God has given us a certain measure of prosperity. And in other times, it shows that our priorities are around physical things rather than, you know, say a focus on God. But here in this situation, I don't even want to try to isolate those ideas so much, but I will say this. There is what we call materialistic physicality. And when we say materialistic physicality, that means that someone's entire life is devoted to nothing but gaining, purchasing items, physical items, and all of these things. And I've said this, I've used this phrase in the past, Gibra Gibora Don Suriel have heard me many times talk about this, but I say that stuff is just dust. It's just dirt, okay? And so when we take into account what and how the process of moving into the next phase of existence, there is a separation of the neshama from the body. And the interesting thing is that the neshama, of course, in Ecclesiastes 12 and 7, it returns to God. But in the same verse, it says, dust will return to dust. Okay, so all of the things that are possessions will eventually come, they will eventually return to the earth. Now, the interesting thing is when the rabbis begin to talk about what purification is, we know that eventually there is going to be a reunion between the body and the neshama, okay? But for a period of time, we live in kind of a semi-intermediate state where the body and the neshama are separated. And according to what the sages and the rabbis say, is at this particular juncture, what happens is, of course, the body breaks down, and that process of breaking down into the elements of the soil again, they say that's painful to the body, and it causes a tremendous pain. And then eventually what you're left with is only perhaps a skeleton or perhaps a fundamental shell that would be the body that would be reanimated by the nefesh, okay, or the neshama. Okay, so what I'm trying to say here is this. Okay, so all of the things that you pursue, if you're a person that all you do is pursue materialistic things and physicality, etc., those things will be gone. Okay, they will be stripped away from the body in a very, you know, according to the sages, again, a very painful process. But nevertheless, when the process has been completed, that stuff doesn't exist anymore. Now, I have said that based on the Ramban, when the Ramban talks about Genesis, Bereshit 1 and 26, and it says, let us make man, the Ramban says that this is a union and a contract and an agreement between earth and Hashem, God himself. And so he says, let us make man in our image. So if what the Ramban says is in any way a truth, then you understand that man is part physical and part dust, part dirt, and he's earth. A measure of him is in earth. And we all know and understand this relatively well. But then another part of him, which is the spirit, of course, again, to Ecclesiastes, says that that returns to God. Okay? Now, in Jude, verse 6, I believe it is, there is a contention between Michael, the archangel, and it says the adversary. And the adversary is basically claiming the body of Moshe, and Michael is arguing with this adversary, saying, no, he wants the body of Moshe. Okay, so my thesis on this idea is that, number one, the adversary is not, quote, the devil, not Satan, not all that, but it's the earth, okay? The earth is saying, you give me back my material. This is the contract that I have between me and God. The dirt's mine, and the spirit is yours. And so Michael is trying to take something in some respects. And this is not a negativity against the whole idea. This is more of an idealistic idea, way of interpreting it. But Michael's trying to take the body as well as the spirit. And why would he want to do that? Well, Moshe did many, many righteous acts, many things that were supernaturally ultra spiritual things. And so you would think that what would be going on is that the body would be able to go with the spirit in those cases. But if my thesis is true, then what you see here is the body of Moshe cannot return or cannot go to God in the way that it was. It has to go through this process of decomposition, and then it has to turn into something that right now we don't have a way of totally explaining it, but eventually it will be called what you call a guf, G-U-F, and that comes from the idea of it just being a vessel. Now, the word for vessel in Hebrew is kli or keli, however you want to say it, and that means basically it's just like a cup. You can take a cup and you can pour whatever liquid or material into it that you want to. And this is the essence of the body, okay? So if this is true, what I have said, then you can't take the body, because the body, even though the body was the vehicle through which you performed all of these, quote, righteous things, it does not get to go. It has to decompose. And then after the decomposition has taken place, then somehow the body and the soul are reunited. But it has to take place, and this is a very key word and something worth writing down. The reunion has to take place through the process of resurrection. Okay? So now when I say that, everybody's, you know, wants to know when the resurrection is going to take place. And again, I have no idea. Some say before the kingdom, some say, and I'm talking about the Yemot HaMashiach, the days of Messiah, some say after, etc. And that's another one of those things that is beyond my scope to know at present. And so I have to say, you know, quite easily, I don't know, but nevertheless, it takes place. But one of the things that should make your spiritual ears, if you were, perk up is that this is an important process that is necessary for this process. And once resurrection has taken place, then the earth no longer can claim the property, claim the dirt as its own property. How do we know this is true? Can anybody give me an answer how I know that is true?
Could it be because God says he's going to bring a new, a renewed heaven and a renewed earth?
Well, I think that that might have something to do with it. And even that in and of itself is another one of those things that's probably beyond what we can totally understand. But that's part of the process, I would say. It has to be something new, but nevertheless.
Adon Ezra has an idea, too.
Okay, Adon Ezra.
Because we're going to be different. We're going
to
change.
Well, is it because that we have to face the judgment for those things we did while here also?
And, okay.
Yeah, that's...
So we're going to, the idea is...
...of the gentleman on the shoulders, the lame and the blind man.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, so, you know, having to go through judgment, then we, after we get done with the judgment, then we can be reunited with the body, and that's when the resurrection would occur. Is that the idea?
Yes, if you will. From what I understand is that the resurrection would begin with the beginning of the days of Messiah's reign. And, you know, the two schools of thought are everybody's resurrected instantly or there's a process.
Right. Which is a great question, right? Is everybody going to be resurrected together? Do you get resurrected one by one? What is the process of that whole event that will take place at the time? Well, forgive me, but you know I'm far more simplistic in many things. But there also is already a precedent. Now, we know that there are people that...
When Yeshua came back.
Yes, absolutely. And
That's
okay. So we know that there are those who were supposed to never have died, right? And in some way... That is a difficult thing to try to explain as well, right? How does this person get to take and go into the spiritual world with a body? Elijah, many different people are said to have done that, not just one or two. Okay, so the real case that is the one that shows us something about the resurrection and the fact that what resurrection does is that it reunites us in a way that in some way strips away the impurities of materialism, etc., and physicality, but lets us enter into, lets the neshama remain in or return to the body. And then once that has taken place, then the union between the two can exist on this new plane. Okay, I say, you know, that the process is going to, the process of decomposition, say on my case, which when I would die, unless Hashem starts with a resurrection with me, which I don't believe is going to be the case, but nevertheless, when we see Yeshua, we see that something happened and we don't fully understand it, because his resurrection, his spirit was separated from his body for a period of time, and then it was re-entered into that body. And then once it re-entered into that body, that we would call a resurrection, then that process makes a person alive to the point that they, in his case, we can definitely say it, but I'm sure this applies to all of us, and that is that we will not again die. Okay, so we have a new body, one that has already been purified, and once it has been purified, then the soul can return to it, and then it can live basically, let's say, eternally, all right? All right, so now, that being said, the idea of the neshama is that thing that is like the atomic energy that we talked about a few minutes ago. And that fragment can take us, you know, forever. You know, it lives in absolute eternity. Now, those, let's take the people around us that, you know, they're not committed to God, as, let's say, as committed to God as we might think we are. And, you know, so you see them that they're doing things that we wouldn't necessarily consider appropriate, etc. And then they die. And what's going to happen? Their body's going to return to the dirt. And it's going to be stripped of all of the things that they had, did, etc. when they were alive. But according to Ecclesiastes, it says that the spirit returns to God. So if the spirit's returning to God, and that thing was connected to a body that lived in physicality all of the time, does the spirit get to stay there? Do you understand what I'm saying? So I'm talking about the people, let's just put it a little bit more blunt, a little bit more frank, and say these people are the people we considered as sinners. And to our knowledge, did they ever confess God in one way or another, or profess to do anything of God? And then, you know, you would say that the process of the body decaying was the process that purified and stripped all of those things away from him. And then once the body and the spirit can be reunited, this thing is connected to God, and does it get to stay in that state? Does it get to enter into the Olam Haba, etc.? Now, and I've used the story before and told the story about, you know, an event that took place when I was young. And though this is the only way I can judge some of those things in a sense that still is perhaps a little bit not ultra spiritual, but nevertheless, when I had an experience, I was offered an opportunity when I believe I had a near-death experience, about 6 years old. And so I believe I was offered a opportunity to stay in the world where I would never have to go through the extreme problem that I went through as, you know, a young boy. And then, you know, which at that time, to the best of my recollection, you know, that sounds like a pretty appealing thing, to never have to go back and never have to suffer that kind of thing again. But the problem was not, you know, do I want to stay here? The problem was twofold. Number one, God has a ministry or a life plan for you that engages other people around you, etc. And so your life is a part of other people's lives in many respects, but God can resolve all of that, and however God could resolve all of that, okay? And then, so that said, you know, it could have been, you know, God rewrites history however so that, you know, I don't have to go back. But the second thing that was even in some respects more telling of the story was, guess what? You get to be there, but there's no reward. There's no accomplishment. You haven't done anything. You get to live there, but that's all you get to do. You don't have anything to show for that other than the fact that you existed for a period of time. Now you don't exist, and you're not going to go back. So, yeah, you get to stay, quote, in the glory, but you don't have any reward to add to it. And so when I look at these people and I say this, the curiosity in my mind is, you know, do they get to stay, but they don't have any reward? What is the outcome of that particular situation? And that is basically speculation, so I can't really answer it. And perhaps you have your opinion on it, and that's well and good too. But this is the by and large, and in one sense, you could say, you know, there's a bad and a good to that. And I'm speaking about the sinners or those people that we might think that they were that way. And the bad side is, guess what? You know, you spent your whole life trying to, you know, buy cars, you know, chase people and, you know, whatever it might be that was your bent for the day. And, you know, now all of that's gone. So, you know, man, that's a sad thing. Everything you worked your whole life for is gone. But the good side is, well, you're here, okay? And so in some ways, perhaps the rabbis, when they talk about some of these things, they kind of come to a bit of a conclusion that, you know, who gets to go? And then, you know, one rabbi says, well, it's the righteous. The righteous people get to go. And then you start to talk about people who are not as righteous as the real righteous people. And so do you say, do they get to go? And they say, yeah, they get to go, but, you know, they don't get the reward of the ones who are truly righteous. And then it's like, you know, wait a minute. We got all of the Gentiles out here. What happens to them? And so for me, the thing is, you know, if I call a person and I said, use that expression we used a few minutes ago, a sinner, then is this what we would say that a Gentile is, a sinner? And I'm not talking about, quote, Christian specifically, okay? That's a whole nother issue that may be whatever, but I'm not, those people have tried in some capacity to live for God, so there again, I'm not the judge on that system, but if I had my two cents, I said, that's got to count for something. God's not going to just say, you know, just because you never became Jewish or whatever, that you can't make it in the door. I don't see God in that way. But nevertheless, you know, so then you take these people, and again, if we call them sinners, then these are the people who never committed to God. They may be Gentile, they may be Jewish or whatever. But, you know, here they are. They made it to this point. They don't have anything to show for it. But perhaps, you know, God will allow them to be the guy that serves us food or whatever. No, I'm just kidding about that. But who knows? That's God's business, not mine. But in my mind, you know, that would make room for anyone to be there. But then again, it raises a lot of problematic questions as to who really gets to go there. Because you can start to think of some really bad people and you say, they get to go there? But then there's one more side of that coin that I kind of deal with a little bit, and that is, you know, who really does get the spark from the beginning? Does everyone get one? Or what is the case? And therein, again, I can't answer that question. But I can say this, that my idea of many of these things, as I believe I said last week, is based on Ephesians 1. And when he starts to talk about those who are chosen, the way that that text can be broken down is that, number one, he chose you. And my typical explanation of that is that he chose you out of the endless seed of Adam's seed, his stream of seed. And so, in one sense, this would seem to lend some credence to the idea that, you know, there are those that were emitted from Adam, but they were not chosen. Okay? And it, again, then, you know, there's those verses where it says many are called and a few are chosen. So, again, you have many things to try to deal with in these circumstances. And believe me, you know, I've not really been one to really, really try to figure out all of those things. But these are a bunch of thoughts that I deal with when it comes to the place of trying to figure out, you know, my place in the whole process, not necessarily everybody else's. Just, you know, what am I trying to accomplish? What am I trying to do? And so then the next step towards that is, I guess somebody went out and somebody came back. Okay. The next point is, you know, maybe to set all of that aside for a moment and then try to deal with the neshama from a perspective of those who pursue God and God is the priority of their life. And or he's, you know, some part of their life, even if he's not the absolute priority. And so there are some things that I have to say about the neshama. And so when I do this, I will go down a short list I have here and hopefully that you can understand my understanding of the neshama. And perhaps, you know, that will enhance some things that you understand. Now, my idea that the earth was the adversary comes from Genesis 1 and 11. In Genesis 1 and 11, he said, "Let the earth bring forth grass, the herb yielding seed, and the fruit tree yielding fruit according to its kind." So what you see here is there's a perpetuation of the thing that grows, but the perpetuation comes from the earth. Okay, so the earth has a force woven into it that in some way it creates things after its own kind, but again it does something that is very similar to this process of resurrection, right? So let's just take, because it's talking about a fruit tree, let's just take an apple or whatever. Okay. Okay, so, you know, the apple tree has an apple on it, and it has produced this fruit, but the seed, whether it is consumed, whether it is just fallen off the tree and, you know, gets into the earth, etc., another tree grows right out of it. So somehow there is a force, an energy of sorts, if you will, that God has invested into the earth that can replicate itself, and but that's all it can do. It says laminehu who here in the Hebrew, and that again is after its kind, but it means that this is a law. Okay, corn cannot make wheat. All right, that's as good as it gets. And the monkey cannot make a whatever, okay? So understand these things when it comes to these rules and these laws, okay? Now, this is invested into the earth, and this is why, you know, I said that the earth says, no, that belongs to me, etc. But what you see in this process of the fruit becoming replicated in and of itself is the process of resurrection. So the seed is a part of the tree that produced a fruit, and then the seed has in it again all of the same things and can reproduce itself again and again and again, okay? But this is very much the same process with humanity, with man, okay? He can replicate, but the difference in man versus the tree is that the seed that is in man has to have stemmed from God. Because what happens is every man gets the passing down of this seed, and then every man, whether we see it or we don't see it or understand it or don't understand it, you know, when that baby takes that first breath, it's God breathing that breath into that child. Okay, and so that in of itself is the animation, the giving of life. Well, it's in its mother's womb. We could more or less kind of say that it's on a life support system. Okay, and so that being said, then that is what it is. Okay, but one of the things that that I see in this process of the neshama, in this whole process is, one of the things that we say when, for example, we eat, and when we eat, let's just say bread, okay? And we say, blessed are you, Lord God, King of the universe, who brings forth the bread from the earth. Okay? So there are a number of things here. The one word that, for me, is the real interesting word here is the word, not universe, but the word in Hebrew is called olam. Okay? And what is olam? Olam is a hard thing to nail down, but I'm going to tell you a little bit of the lexical data, but I'm not going to try to, you know, thump the lexicon real hard when we do this. But the interesting thing is that the word olam actually has the idea of something that is hidden. Okay, so if we said the olam hazeh, we're talking about this present world. But if we use olam and then we say hazeh, this present world is basically how we do it, then to add that word olam to this present world means that there's a hidden aspect to this world that we live in. And there's a hidden aspect to everything that goes on in our life every day, okay? But, you know, one of the words that we see and we know about in the promise of, quote, eternal life is what we call the Olam Haba, okay? The Olam Haba, as we've said, is the world that is coming. But really, the idea of Olam Hazeh is like this position in between what has taken place before, which is also the word Olam, because it can mean antiquity. It can mean eternity, but it never means eternity in the sense of the past. It's always a point of origin in the past where it begins. Of course, which of this speaks to us of creation, right? And or, you know, my point of origin or whatever, however that process begins. But now, that being said, the Olam Hazeh is this point that literally is a point in transition. We never are in the present. We experienced just a second ago, we experienced the present, but now we're, and it's repetitive, as you see. We're never there. So in one sense, this is the Olam Hazeh, but the Olam Hazeh is the moment that passes, you know, as quickly as, you know, the clock does, or however you want to say it, and it passes, and then the Olam Haba comes. Okay, now how does this relate to the bread? How does it relate to the bread? The bread is in this. It said, blessed are you, God, O Lord God, King of the Olam. Okay, so Olam is this place where God is, and then, of course, for us, that means he's everywhere. He is eternal in the past, but he's eternal in the future. But from whatever point that we began, because we have a piece of this divine spark in the neshama, you know, our forward movement is now considered to be eternal. Okay, is it getting too complex? Everybody still with me? Got all the cards in the right place? Okay, so it says that God is the king of the cosmos. But what God did, according to the prayer, is the blessing, is that he brought bread forth from the earth. In one sense, this ties two things together. Number one, it ties God together with the cosmos. He's the king of the Olam. So we translate that as cosmos, the earth, however, you know, it basically plays out into the way that we use it in that connection, the word Olam, of course. And so what God did is create a man, Adam, and then Adam defied the orders of God. And you know how deeply rebellious you define that is, you know, whatever. Some sages are of the mind that it was, you know, a violently abusive thing. He abused the laws of God. And then others say, you know, no, he was just trying to accomplish something that we all know that happens in life. You know, absence makes the heart go fonder, as they say. Now, this said, what happened when Adam sinned, you remember from the Talmud and from the oral Torah, says Adam's feet were on the earth, but his head and his upper portions were in the spiritual worlds, or in, quote, the cosmos, the Olam, partially in the Olam Hazeh. So, when Adam sins, part of his punishment is that now he's confined to this body on this particular planet, and, you know, he's relegated to being subordinate much more to his flesh, right? So God tells him, look, you're going to eat your bread. How are you going to eat it? In the dust, you know, on your face, and the sweat on your brow, etc. This is how you're going to eat your bread. Okay? But here's the interesting thing. What happens when Adam sins, when he falls? There's something that happens to literally the entire cosmos. It makes a fracture of the entire cosmos. And this fracture has to have the presence of God in it. Otherwise, however we try to do it, you know how, have you ever seen something that starts to spin? And when it starts spinning, you know, the gravitational force is starting to pull it apart. And then if it keeps going and going and going, if it starts, it goes too fast, it will come apart. And some of that is how we could see the cosmos in a way. What happened with Adam was that in one sense, he had a very, very deep spiritual idea. But he was going far beyond, you know, his limit at that particular time. And when he did, he broke it. He broke everything. He didn't just break himself. He broke everything. And so now, all the fragments of Earth are strewn out through the cosmos. And isn't it interesting? I don't know that this is an absolute fact, but it's my interesting. You ever notice how frequently, you know, these comets, they come back around and we see them again? And then they're gone for how long? And then they come back? You know, it's like they come back to see us again, and, you know, they're a part of us. And, you know, when you look at the moon, you wonder what happened to the moon, and, you know, how did it get all of those dots in it and all this. So my idea here is that the cosmos was fractured by what happened from Adam HaRishon and his turning away to try to do something positive, but nevertheless, it was a tremendous failure, okay? And so that failure has been handed down to us. Here we are trying to deal with it. But this is one of the reasons why we say, blessed are you, O Lord God, King of the cosmos. Because the only thing holding it all together at this point is the power of God, God Himself. But in this process of God holding it together and being King of the cosmos, as it were, then, only then can God. And we say God brought it forth. But wait a minute, what about the farmer? What did he do? What part did he have? Can we say that the farmer brought it forth from the earth? Well, if you look at it like this, you say, yeah, well, he's the guy that, you know, he made the furrow, he planted the seed. But, you know, back in days in antiquity, oh, yeah, I'm sure they'd use irrigation systems. There's no two ways about it. You know, this idea of these great big rotators in the middle of these fields today, that's not a new idea, you know. And, you know, it's one idea to think about God and, you know, pray to God that we get the right rain, etc. But at the same time, you go to Israel today, you know how to tell that you're in an Israeli-occupied part of the country? Look for the green line. Why is that? Because the Jew wants to plant a flower, and he knows, guess what? It's got to have water. And even though he blesses God for the water at the appropriate time, the rain, etc. He still knows that, you know what, we do this. But now here we are back to the idea that guess what? You know, God has gathered the fragments of the universe together that need to be used so that earth can come forth from the ground. So once the seed grows, all of this is beyond man's capacity to actually create. You know, man might now be able to genetically do this and do that, but it's, as I said a week or two ago, whatever it was, you know, and it doesn't bother me. I'm not worried by it. Why? Because they haven't learned to make their own dirt yet. You know, and that would mean that, you know, if they're going to make their own dirt, they have to disassemble themselves first. Right? Because they're property of something else. They belong to God, not to themselves. So, you know, when some people worry over those things, it's not that I sit and laugh, but I don't worry because, you know, for me, God's in control. And if God's not in control, we might as well just give it up. You know, and so are there things to worry about? Oh, absolutely. You know, every day. But guess what? My confidence still in every day. I go to bed, and when I go to bed at night, my problem with sleeping is not because I'm worried. It's because I'm trying to think about the things of God, not because I'm trying to worry about, you know, what will happen tomorrow. But that said, now, you know, we say this, so the cosmic dust is out there and God gathers that in some way, because in my mind, for some reason, and I don't know why this would be other than it's something well beyond God or beyond my mind, and it's something only of God. And that's because, you know, the fragment of what Adam did to the cosmos has strewn part of the elements that are necessary for bread to come forth from the earth, the apple to come from the earth, all of these things that the earth needs, it still needs God in it to hold all these things together, okay? So there was, for a period of time, it's as if parts of the earth are in exile. And the parts of earth that are in exile have been strewn out through the cosmos. Now, this is where the mind starts to truly, truly grasp at straws. Okay, the way we understand the cosmos at present is, you know, the thing that's keeping you and I warm is the sun. You know, the thing that gives us light at night, that's the moon and the stars and all these things. But what did it really look like on the day that God created it? On the day that God created Adam, were all these fragments in the cosmos? And was the earth at some point in time, let's say, much more enormous than what it is now? Are you with me? There are gigantic planets out there. Look at even the planets in our little solar system right here. Hundreds of times larger. Were any of those possibly a fragment of the earth that existed before? I don't know. But something to think about tonight when you go to sleep. If you need any reassurance, just call Gibberette Miriam. She's awake at 2:30. She and Sheba will, you guys can have a conversation at that. You can probably even use VC at that hour. I don't know. I've never tried it before, but it might work. Okay, so I see that, you know, there are a million possibilities about this whole process. But I see that man now in exile is, in a sense, in the same thing, you know. So when Adam was... when he sinned and he was fragmented, pieces of him were probably strewn through the cosmos. And in some ways, this is back down to the more Kabbalistic ideas of the missing sparks that need to be redeemed and regathered, etc. And there's a million ways to try to talk about those things, good, bad, and indifferent. So we'll just keep going, okay? But nevertheless, this whole idea of God being the king of eternity is because God is the part that holds it all together. And without him, we cannot comprehend even existence in the minimal. But now we get back to the neshama being a fragment of God. And we see that the neshama is basically something that is continually moving through time. And I've said this to some people, and some people probably think I'm crazy as can be, but I say that the neshama is the real time traveler. Now, how do you say that? First of all, I could say, and this happens to us in some ways that are very, very peculiar, and we have these things that we call deja vu, and we don't understand, you know, sometimes we experience these deja vu, and if you're like me, I don't know how to say this, but, you know, if I have this, there's two points to the deja vu, okay? The point of origin, where this thing is that you saw or you experienced or whatever, wherever it happened, and then this place in the future where you recall it, okay? Now me, when I look at deja vu, when I look at my deja vu, what happens to me, I say, oh, man, I had that point of origin years and years ago. And then there are things that happen, and I don't know if this happens to you or not. I'll bet it does. Have you ever just started to fall asleep, and then all of a sudden you're in some other mode of existence or reality, whatever you want to say, and you're doing something, and then all of a sudden that's gone, but you're thinking, where in the world did that come from? You know, was that the pizza last night, or was that, you know, what was that? But there's a connection between this and this idea of the neshama being a real time traveler. Well, it's not quite like, you know, Jules Verne's thing, but nevertheless, here's the point, you know. At some point, God talked to you before he put you in a body. And he discussed these things with you. Now, some of those things, you know, are, you know, things that maybe are a part of the deja vu. But, you know, we have a lot of memories as well. But at some point he talked to you and then he deposits you there. So you have this point of origin. But the soul, the neshama, my opinion, my idea is that the neshama is sitting with God. And then God's asking it, okay, look, this is your mission. This is what I want you to do. And you need to be holy. You need to be this. You need to be that. And then all of a sudden, you know, here we are. We're in the middle of things. But before we get put in a body, the neshama makes a choice. Your neshama makes a choice. This is the path I'm going to take. Now, I'm going to tell you something. Some days I feel like I get left out because I don't remember that. And I'm saying, like, you know, you made the choice, but now here I'm the guy dealing with all of this stuff, and where are you? You know, I don't know you. I can't connect with you. But in some way, the neshama is this aspect of us and God in a unity, and the neshama knows things that it only reveals to us basically as we need these things. But it has picked the route out through its point of origin through eternity. And it has picked out the route that it feels like is the one that will best serve for us being a part of the mission. Now the difficulty is, you know, we don't fully realize or remember these things, but nevertheless they exist, or it exists. So in the sense, the neshama has made the plan, but it started out at a point where God had a communication with it, and then it said, this is what I'm going to do, and this is my plan of action. And God and the neshama agree, then the body, the neshama gets put into a body at whatever place and point of time that it happens, whether it's a transmigration, once, twice, three times, if there is such a thing. None of it is beyond the scope of our possible awareness. Do we do it? Do we not do it? I don't know. You know, I can't say specifically every time that I can remember when I was alive before or whatever. You know, my best connection to those things is through the neshama and somewhat through the deja vu. But in many senses, I'm saying, okay, God, you know, the next time I go around, I really would like to be born Jewish, not have to convert. Okay, be born into this thing to where, you know, I don't have to struggle with the Gentile in me. And don't have to keep that dog in the cage, etc. Okay? Yeah, if you don't have that problem, you know, Baruch Hashem, bless God. So basically, I'm going to sum up with the idea that, you know, what the soul naturally is a combination. It's a harmonizing of several different faculties, which we all know, the Nefesh, the Ruach, the Neshama, the Chaya, and the Yechida. But this process of it moving through future and through the past and being in existence in, say, the cosmos is something that is very profound. But now back to the idea of the four worlds, which are part of the Kabbalistic idea of the worlds. I say, number one, the Neshama supersedes all of those. Okay, it's above Atzilut, if you understand and know which one that is. You understand that's the one where only God lives. But it is important that the neshama can exist above that because the whole purpose of the neshama is to bring us closer to God and bring us in harmony and in union with God. So being in harmony and in union with God, what happens is, you know, it has to have a time when it can communicate with God. So it cannot be restricted to any particular sphere. It has to be above that. So not only is it above those spheres, it also has the ability to see above all of those spheres, and it also has a capacity to see through history forward and backward and see that what it has to do is it has to capture the future and the present. And that is exactly what the neshama is doing. It sees the eternity and it sees how to guide the soul, guide the human part of us, however we're all connected together. And as it guides us through this process and it carries us into the future. And through this mechanism, this we know is how we will spend eternity, or the reason that we have an eternal life. But at some point, there's going to be the new heavens and the new earth, which Gibra Gibora was speaking of earlier. But those things we don't even fully understand. It says there's no more sea, there's no more sun, etc. But the neshama can see that and understand it, but at present, we cannot see that. But here's a verse that is very interesting to me, and this comes from Ecclesiastes chapter 3. And we'll start reading at verse 9 and read through 13. What profit has the worker from all that which he labors? He said, I've seen the God-given task which the sons of men are occupied with. He's made everything beautiful in its time, but he put eternity in their hearts, except that no man can find out the work of God that God does from beginning to end. And then he says, I know that nothing is better for them than to rejoice and to do good in their lives, and also that every man should eat and drink and enjoy the good of his labor. It is a gift of God. But the profound thing that I found in that verse was he says, and he put eternity into their hearts. Why do you have a desire to live forever? Because God put eternity inside of you. And here again is a connection, I say, to the neshama, right? And this is a connection between neshama and olam. The present world, the future world, and literally the past all exist at one point as the neshama walks us through the place that we are now to in the future, from the place that we communicated with God, God communicated with us, to our place in the future.